Hello, this is Randy Thompson from the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to Music Review. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. For the next half hour, I shall be reading articles about music from such sources as the New York Times, the News and Observer, the Week Magazine, Rolling Stone, and Entertainment Weekly. Music Review is underwritten by Bill McClure, tuning pianos in the Raleigh area since 1968. For more information or to schedule a piano tuning appointment, please call 919-779-1755. This program is designed to provide the latest coverage of classical, folk, jazz, blues, rock, country, and pop music news. But first, these musical trivia questions. Today's trivia questions come to us from the website onthisday.com. Question number one. It was on this day back in 1956 that for the very first time in Billboard chart history, five singles were in both the pop and the R&B top ten. Which one of the following was not in that history-making list? Was it A, Carl Perkins' Blue Suede Shoes? Was it B, The Monkees' I'm a Believer? Was it C, The Platters' Magic Touch? Or was it D, Elvis Presley' Heartbreak Hotel? So which one of the above singles was not both an R&B and pop number one in 1956? And question number two, what did Loretta Lynn announce at the Grand Ole Opry back in 1998 today? Was it A, that she intended to return to college and get a degree? Was it B, that she was using a recording of her voice at that Grand Ole Opry concert? Was it C, that a medical condition has prevented her from ever singing again? Or was it D, that she was dating Jim Henson of Kermit the Frog fame? So what was the announcement Loretta Lynn made on this day back in 1998? The answers to these two important trivia questions will be given, as usual, at the end of today's program. Our transitions come to us from that same website, onthisday.com. And today, quote-unquote, is the weekend of May the 2nd. Well, it was on this very day, back in 1939, that Beer Barrel Polka was recorded by the Andrews Sisters. The Beer Barrel Polka, known also as Roll Out the Barrel, originated in Czechoslovakia in 1927. The song's melody became popular with soldiers during World War II, and the lyrics were translated into multiple languages. A Tin Pan Alley publisher, Shapiro Bernstein, acquired the night's rights to the song and created the lyrics for the English version titled Beer Barrel Polka in 1934 after Prohibition was repealed. Andrew Sisters today, 1939. And it was 39 years ago today, 1986, that Dollywood, Dolly Parton's theme park, opened in Pigeon Forge, Tennessee. The theme park was renamed Dollywood in 1986 when Dolly Parton became a part owner and partner. Prior to that, the park had been known as Rebel Railroad, 1961, Gold Rush Junction, 1970, and Silver Dollar City, 1976. Dollywood is open and operating as of the current date, April 13, 2025. Vivaldi Spring opens our classical music news. It's titled, Do You Actually Know What Classical Music Is? Does anyone? The term is applied to radically different compositions across more than 1,000 years of history. We need a better definition. This is written by Matthew Aucoin, The Atlantic Magazine, May 2025 issue. If most music lovers were asked to identify the defining characteristics of their favorite genre, jazz, folk, rock, hip-hop, I would guess that they might simply say, well, it sounds a certain way. It's music, they might go on, that tends to have a particular rhythmic feel, or that usually features, say, the saxophone, or the electric guitar, or the sitar. Presented with exceptions to these patterns, what about a cappella jazz ensembles? What about unplugged rock albums? Most listeners would likely offer some variant of, I know it when I hear it. But, counterintuitive though it may seem, I don't think sound is always a helpful way to understand genre. I'm a composer and a conductor in the field that's broadly known as Western classical music, a term that's routinely applied to radically different idioms across more than 1,000 years of musical history. Within this huge array, you'll find the engulfing sonorities of William Byrd's choral music, the intimate revelations too private for words in chamber works by Franz Schubert and Anton Webern, the majestic topography of Jean Sibelius's orchestral landscapes, and more recently, a multitude of works by composers that are very different from one another. The unruly and elusive entity known as classical music does not sound like any one thing, and the sheer abundance of the tradition might invite the conclusion that trying to define it at all is a hopeless exercise. But that would be a mistake, especially at this moment. Like every other sector of cultural life, classical music has been roiled over the past decade by intense debates about the field's ongoing lack of diversity among performing artists, composers, and leaders of musical organizations. The stakes of these discussions, which have involved charges of Eurocentrism, head-in-the-sand elitism, even white supremacy, have at times felt existential, given many institutions' financial straits. Maintaining a 90-piece orchestra is generally a money-losing proposition in America today, and as a result, classical music organizations lean heavily on private donations. The author, Matthew Aucoin's Vocal Symphony, called Music for New Bodies, is based on the poetry of Jory Graham, and it will be featured at the Tanglewood Music Festival in summer 2025. He is a composer and a conductor. Ray Charles' Drown in My Own Tears introduces our R&B music news. It's titled Ray Charles and Disability. This is published in February 2016, music.si.edu, Smithsonian Music by Reagan Schrum. Ray Charles broke down many barriers both as a musician and an African American. He defied genre categorization and frequently intertwined R&B, pop, gospel, and country music in various combinations. Charles also lent his voice to the civil rights movement. He provided financial support to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and even refused to play for segregated concerts in 1961 after receiving a letter from Payne College's student president. However, not much has been written on Charles's advocacy for people with disabilities. Perhaps that's in part because he disregarded his own disability. He stalwartly refused to let it limit him. Throughout the mid-19th century and continuing well into the 20th century, medical treatment and information were not equally available to Americans. The number of blind and visually impaired Americans greatly varied across race and economic class. In general, blindness was closely linked with poverty. As many African Americans were living in insufficient conditions, there were a significant number of blind African Americans during this period. Before Charles was even born, many blind African American musicians established national reputations, including pianist Blind Tom Wiggins and singer-guitarist Blind Lemon Jefferson. However, the word blind functioned as a professional nickname used to market and exploit their disability. Adding the word blind to these musicians' names served to make them stereotyped others. One form of a blindness myth, Joseph Wittek observed, is that of the suffering blues singer begging with a tin cup. This formulation casts blindness as the mark of a cruel fate, which caps the singer's degradation and alienates him from his community. However, Charles was born in a time when blind and visual impairment was becoming less common in the United States. To maintain Jim Crow laws and practices, Southern African Americans were not offered consistent health care, but white physicians began to prognose African Americans as they knew it could be useful for the general population. Charles himself was not born blind, but slowly started losing his vision at the age of 4 due to what was later diagnosed as glaucoma. While neighbors in Charles's hometown of Greenville, Florida, pitied the boy, Charles's mother, Retha, had no patience for sympathy. Charles later recounts that when I got to feeling sorry for myself, she'd get tough and say, "You're blind, you ain't dumb. You lost your sight, not your mind." And she'd make me see I could do almost anything anyone else could do. This determination and rejection of his blindness struck and stuck with Charles for the rest of his life. In 1937, the 7-year-old Charles was sent to St. Augustine, Florida, to attend what was then known as the Florida School for the Deaf and the Blind. The school was strictly segregated, dividing males and females, as well as African Americans and whites. As the general case was for all segregated schools, the African-American facilities were significantly inferior. The African-American children were given cast-off supplies from their white sister school, including not only worn furniture, leftover food, and chipped tableware, but also braille books with dots so faded they were hard to distinguish. While Charles was given an elementary school education, the African-American children were also required to learn practical skills that would help support the school. Charles's main task was to sew bands around straw brooms. At the school, Charles not only learned Braille and sign language as a means of communicating with the deaf children, but also Braille music. When Louis Braille first invented the system of raised dots that could be read by fingertip in 1824, he soon later devised Braille music. This code still used the Braille dots, but had its own entirely separate meaning. However, reading Braille music posed difficulties, as Charles had to play the piano with his left hand while reading with his right, and then switch positions to learn the keys on the other hand. Because of this arduousness, Charles would just memorize the song by heart instead of going back to read the score. That same year of 1937, Charles became completely blind as his right eye was removed due to its painfulness. But Charles tried to distance himself from the tradition of blind African-American singers before him. Charles refused to play a guitar because seems like every blind blues singer I've heard about was playing a guitar. Furthermore, though, blind and visually impaired individuals' use of a white cane had become standard by the 1930s, and in fact was a powerful symbol of independence for many. Charles refused to use the device. Charles affirmed, "Now it's important that you understand that there were three things I never wanted to own when I was a kid: a dog, a cane, and a guitar. In my brain, they each meant blindness and helplessness. After experiencing chronic ear troubles leading to temporary hearing loss, Charles incorporated the Robinson Foundation for Hearing Disorders in 1986. His foundation provided cochlear implants for low-income patients, as well as funding forwards towards research for hearing improvements. Through his foundation, as well as determination to not let his blindness disable him, Charles broke down expectations and stereotypes for disabilities. In fact, in 1994, Charles was honored with the Helen Keller Personal Achievement Award, which celebrates individuals who have improved the lives of disabled peoples. A picture, by the way, of a white cane is in the article with a caption that reads, "This foldable white cane belonged to Kenneth Jernigan, president of the National Federation of the Blind, from 1968 to 1986. Though blind and visually impaired people had been using canes for centuries, the white cane that was easily visible due to its color was introduced after World War I. By the 1930s, white cane ordinances were passed, allowing people carrying that cane to have a right of way. And in music research and technology, we have this article titled, "The World in Six Songs: How the Musical Brain Created Human Nature." This is a review of Daniel Levitin's paperback on July 28, 2009, and it's given 4.4 out of 5 possible stars by the reviewer in Amazon.com. The author of the New York Times bestseller, This Is Your Brain on Music, reveals music's role in the evolution of human culture in this thought-provoking book that will leave you awestruck, according to the New York Times. Daniel J. Levitin's astounding debut bestseller, This Is Your Brain on Music, enthralled and delighted readers as it transformed our understanding of how music gets in our heads and stays there. Now, in his second New York Times bestseller, his genius for combining science and art reveals how music shaped humanity across cultures and throughout history. Here he identifies 6 fundamental song functions or types: friendship, joy, comfort, religion, knowledge, and love, then shows how each in its own way has enabled the social bonding necessary for human culture and society to evolve. He shows, in effect, how these six songs work in our brains to preserve the emotional history of our lives and species. Dr. Levitin combines cutting-edge scientific research from his music cognition lab at McGill University and work in an array of related fields. His own sometimes hilarious experiences in the music business, and illuminating interviews with musicians such as Sting and David Byrne, as well as conductors, anthropologists, and evolutionary biologists. The World in Six Songs is ultimately a revolution in our understanding of how human nature evolved, right up to the iPod.
Walking down 29th and Park, I saw you in another's arm. Only a month we've been apart, you look happier.
Ed Sheeran's Happier introduces our rock and pop music news. It's titled The 100 Most Influential People in the World. It's from Time magazine, April 28, 2025. And one of those 100 is Ed Sheeran, open-hearted storyteller. And this is written by Chris Hemsworth. I'm fortunate enough to meet some of the most talented people in the world. But every now and then I come across a person who isn't just talented, there's something else entirely. Ed Sheeran has an almost supernatural ability to connect. His songs, his voice, his words, they belong to all of us. Whether you're at home with your headphones on, driving through the countryside, or in a stadium packed with 70,000 people singing at the top of their lungs, his music feels personal. He has an instinct for storytelling that makes you feel like he wrote that song just for you, no matter where you're from or what you've been through. But beyond the music, beyond the palpable anticipation for his upcoming album, and the stadiums full of people hanging on to every note, is the man himself. Ed is one of the most kind-hearted, down-to-earth people I've ever met. He's got this incredible ability to make you feel like you've been mates forever, even if you just met 5 minutes ago. There's no ego, no pretension, just warmth, laughter, and a wicked sense of humor. He can go from writing a beautiful song to cracking a joke so ridiculous you forgot what you were talking about in the first place. Ed brings people together in a way that few can. He writes the songs that become the soundtrack to our lives. He makes strangers feel like family. He doesn't just perform for an audience. He creates a world where everyone is welcome. By the way, the author of this, Hemsworth, is an actor and a producer. So how did you do on today's trivia questions? Well, the answer to our first question, it was on this day back in 1956 that, for the first time in Billboard chart history, five singles were in both the pop and the R&B top ten. Which one of the following was not in that history-making list? Was that A, Carl Perkins' Blue Suede Shoes, B, The Monkees' I'm a Believer, C, The Platters' Magic Touch, or D, Elvis Presley's Heartbreak Hotel? Correct answer, answer B, I'm a Believer by The Monkees. This song wasn't even released until 1967. Also, The Monkees were not really known for their R&B tunes. As noted in OnThisDay.com, it was on this day in 1956 that for the first time in Billboard chart history, five singles were in both the pop and R&B top ten. The singles, Elvis Presley's Heartbreak Hotel, Carl Perkins' Blue Suede Shoes, Little Richard's Long Tall Pat Sally, The Platters' Magic Touch, and Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers' Why Do Fools Fall in Love? And the answer to our second question, what did Loretta Lynn announce at the Grand Ole Opry on this day back in 1988? Was it A, that she intended to return to college and get a degree? Was it B, that she was using a recording of her voice at the Grand Ole Opry concert? Was it C, that a medical condition has prevented her from ever singing again? Or was it D, that she was dating Jim Henson of Kermit the Frog fame? Correct answer? Well, as noted in OnThisDay.com, Loretta Lynn made the announcement backstage at the Grand Ole Opry in 1998 that she intended to return to college and get a degree. Correct answer? Answer A. Although she never did pursue a traditional college degree, as noted in a 12702 Billboard.com article, the University of Kentucky's Board of Trustees approved an honorary doctorate for the 66-year-old country singer and Johnson County, Kentucky native. Lynn received the honorary doctorate in arts at a ceremony during the Society for American Music's 28th annual meeting in March 2022. And by the way, Lynn also received an honorary Doctor of Music degree from Berklee College of Music in 2007. So, let's close out today's program with Dr. Loretta Lynn's Coal Miner's Daughter. Oh, well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Music Review. Be sure to tune in at the same time next week. This program's also available as a podcast after the broadcast in our website, ncreadingservice.org. As we leave you now, remember these words. Kindness is a language which blind people see and deaf people hear. Content of this program intended for people who are blind or print impaired. If you have a suggestion for music to feature on this program, please leave a message for me at 919-832-5138. I'm Randy Thompson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Music Review, underwritten by Bill McClure. Tuning pianos in the Raleigh area since 1968. For more information or to schedule a piano tuning, please call 919-779-1755. So long. Until next time.
Standing way. In the summertime, we didn't have shoes to wear. But in the wintertime, we'd all get a brand new pair. From a mail order catalog, money made from selling a hog. Daddy always managed to get the money somewhere.